How do you protect a president on a day like today? Let's ask someone who's done it. Paul Ekloff, retired Secret Service. Thank you for your service.
Absolutely. Thank you. Great to be here.
Today is like the Super Bowl of Secret Service days, right?
Absolutely. Today's like the Super Bowl of Super Bowls. This, well, it would have been the largest security event in their history. And if you consider they had 9,000 security events in 2024 alone, they have a few. Moving indoors because of the weather for the majority of events certainly will help. But yes, today
that's a big sigh of relief
step.
To you guys when you hear it's going inside.
It is to the post-standers who get to go inside. I would say an event inside still means the majority of the security is standing outside in the cold.
Oh.
So, while for the mission, you're glad it's inside, for your own feet and fingertips, you're still trying to prepare for the cold.
So you were Secret Service for George W., for Barack, and for Trump, correct?
I was indeed. I was on their specific Presidential Protective Division details for those three presidents.
And you've done different things for inauguration security, right? You've played the president in training scenarios?
I did. I've been involved in securing five different inaugurations, and for one specific one, for the real elaborate training that we do at our training center, I played both the president and the vice president in the scenarios.
Okay. Do you have to do the voice when you...
I thought I said I was not going to do this, but you don't have to do the voice. So I would say it's not a mission requirement. But when I was George Bush, I can either confirm or deny whether I went into fully into character with the voice or not.
Well, you got to play the part. So you did a good job.
Right.
You have to give a few speeches because we reenact the inaugural balls. We reenact the parade route. We reenact any number of scenarios. And you do kind of have to make sure that the supervisors have a realistic training environment. And my job was essentially during the scenarios where the attackers would not reach close enough to get to the president. My job was to increase the tension. And I chose to do that by pestering them as George W. Bush.
Miss me.
Increased attention. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was in most scenarios, and because of Secret Service's layered protocol, the attackers are never going to get close to the president. He's stashed in an undisclosed location, even if that's a hallway bathroom that's hardened with cinder blocks. And the secure perimeter can be built up until the problem is put down. But you want your supervisors to feel the real tension. So as the protectee who's standing in a shower stall happens to be me yelling, Eddie and Nikki, get me out of this shower. I look terrible. Get me out of there. I need to talk to Condi. I need to talk to Dick. I was better at it when I was around him more. I didn't make any friends that day with the supervisors. And I did increase their tension, though, maybe not in the way I'd planned.
You were in one of the scenarios, you were playing, I think, GW, and you got pushed into a limo, right? It was, what was it? You were simulating an air assault?
We were simulating the motorcade route along the inaugural parade, where you're walking there with the first lady and you're waving at the crowd. We had simulated crowds. We had the actual vehicles, and that motorcade is 50 to 100 cars, and you have different scenarios planned to test the detail in all of the groups. In this one, we had an aerial assault. Our opposition force launched a homemade mortar towards the vehicle. Well, when this is first detected, the response is to evacuate the president into that steel armored limousine. This was the first year, and we were preparing this in 2004 before the new beast had become public. We were practicing with it. Well, it has a lower ceiling than the public would know, and without exposing national security secrets, you could imagine it's just a giant tank that looks like a Cadillac.
Right.
So when this missile came in, the rather large men and women who protect the president grabbed me off of my feet and started to ran me at full speed towards the limo. I know the sill is low. I can see the chrome and know that it's an undisclosed number of inches below that, and I've got to duck. Well, I ducked as much as I could, but that last shove, kind of like the Philly tush push, rammed me at a full sprint head first into a M1 Abrams weighted vehicle and knocked me out.
Damn!
I woke up in a heap on the floor with them on top of me, much like you see the videos and the stories when Ronald Reagan was shot. at the Hilton in D.C. with blood coming down my face and my head a little crooked. And they're remarking, oh, my, that fake hat, fake blood in his hat's remarkable. It's really real.
Not
they're,
fake.
They're touching it and trying to figure it out. And I just looked up at them and I gave a word we used to use when an undercover scenario goes south. You just used to say Acapulco. And they don't use that anymore. So I can expose that. And so I just looked up with my eyes in two different directions and said, Acapulco. And
I think
they knew I was in trouble. So if you're ever in trouble somewhere, just look at your friends and say, Acapulco. And they're supposed to get you out of it.
It's a great restaurant in Stratford.
Paul Eklof is on, retired Secret Service, talking about the inauguration today. Well, the lesson there was, we got to throw him into the car, but we got to throw him lower.
We got to throw the president lower. So, yeah, if you practice bowling with the president or throwing him into the vehicle. And it was we had higher sealed vehicles up to this point in history. So for the 2005 inauguration, the first inauguration of President Obama, we were introducing these new remarkable state-of-the-art vehicles. Well, state-of-the-art meant more steel and more explosive protection from things. And so they did learn. Now, unfortunately, they did it the first day as Dick Cheney, and then the second, and I was too dazed or concussed or just plain stupid. I hope I don't appear on one of your shows that I researched. I don't want to end up on Dumbass News. But
wow, you are good.
I ended up, probably belong there, but I ended up 2 days in a row. So that was two of my 7 major concussions while on the job that I can proudly.
Can you imagine if they saving the president from like a bomb attack?
Right.
And then you throw him into the car and you break his neck.
Oops.
It's like, damn it.
This is close.
We almost saved him. Then we killed him.
We almost saved him. And that's what they thought had happened when Ronald Reagan was shot in 1981. They got in the vehicle and the agent in charge was assessing him. And the president thought that, you know, you broke my rib. You dove on me. No, he'd been shot with a Devastator bullet by John Hinckley.
Yeah.
And they decided to divert. Instead of going to the White House, they went to the hospital. And to this very day, because of that, anytime the president is anywhere, there's an agent in the nearest hospital waiting for him with a plan.
Wow. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because of that assassination attempt.
They're on standby.
Because of that assassination attempt, we do vulnerability assessments and have security plans for every high enough trauma center within the vicinity of the president, even ones he flies over that might have to divert to. There's an agent waiting in there. I did that very, very early in my career in a trauma center in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it was kind of funny because I was sitting there at a computer and I was watching these horrible traumas come in and trying to learn from it. And I would Google what was going on to try to learn about it. I was a high school biology teacher, which is another show in itself, before I became a Secret Service agent. And a doctor was going by doing the rounds with his interns, and he was quizzing them on what the treatment would be for this particular individual who had hung himself. And I had been Googling it, and none of them knew. They were too scared to answer, so I raised my hand and gave the most in-depth medical explanation of a C3 fracture of the cervical vertebrae and what needed to be done. And they just had this stunned look, and he screamed at him that if the dumb Secret Service agent knew, they had to go back to class.
It's like, well, that happened to me when they threw me in the limo.
Exactly. Anyway, this was before that. I could only imagine that something as exciting as being thrown into a limo. I think it was on purpose because it was after I was tormenting them with the Bush accent. So I'm wondering if it was payback.
Yeah, that was it. Don't ever do that again.
That was night-night.
Paul Eklof is on, retired Secret Service. That's Inauguration Day parade, the tradition where the president gets out and then walks. Is that the worst, like, Secret Service nightmare, protecting that moment right then?
The problem is that it is the worst nightmare, and it's not protecting that moment. It's because it's a moment that never seems to end. It's like that nightmare hallway that you're running down that just gets longer and longer. The inaugural parade route is so long, and the number of exposures from rooftops, and if you were to count the windows along that route where there could be an assassin, and while there had not been an assassin with a rifle since 1981, and certainly not two assassination attempts since 1975, what we saw this summer in July and September and those horrible assassination attempts and the murder of the father in Pennsylvania, I know that this year the alert was going to be incredibly heightened. But to be going along that parade route in any capacity, and there are thousands of different submissions of the Secret Service and their federal, state, and local partners. It's not just the Secret Service. They're a very small agency as far as law enforcement and security goes. There's only 3,200 agents worldwide and over 130 field offices. There will be 25,000 police officers and military in D.C. today.
It's insane to try to coordinate all that.
Right.
Coordinating that, that's why they're designated as national special security events, which are events of the highest security, and they bring in every federal agency ahead of time. Instead of like what we saw in Butler, everybody's sort of chasing its tail to figure out who's in charge, who investigates this.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that in a second. But you know, on this parade thing, I see Kennedy in that the footage, the horrible footage, right before, you know, everyone's happy, he's in the convertible. And you think, you know, a president in a convertible driving through a city is kind of a bad idea. And every time I see a president get out of the car and walk down the parade route, I'm like, you know, it seems like a bad idea. And it just seems like it's going to take a bad thing happening for them to end that tradition. You guys must tell them every 4 years, like, you know, we'd love it if you didn't get out of the car.
We'd love it if they never left the White House. If they could just stay in the basement, in the closet, in the theater, maybe.
Right.
Watch a movie, Mr. President. Although the last time I was in the president's theater with President Obama, we had a fence jumper. I still don't know how the movie
was. That the guy who went through the front door?
No, that was a different one. He was in the residence or out of the residence at the time. This was one who jumped the fence and just didn't get very far because they tend to think, well, the agents and officers will never shoot them. But the dogs really don't care. They'll bite anybody. So they get taken to the ground pretty quickly.
You can't outrun them.
You cannot outrun them. They are pretty fast. But that motorcade route, ever the president steps outside, that vulnerability and exposure time is one of the key features of any vulnerability assessment. So if you're walking a parade route for 2 hours, it's just harrowing. Now, there are plans in place, and I assure you the president's jacket can take a round or two, as well as the other things on it. But as far as the Kennedy one, I started my career back in 1998 in the Dallas field office, so I know all the real secrets because we would walk through that. But that shot was so easy that year, the distance, the timing, that open car. What most people don't know is that vehicle, which had a designation, was put back in the shop, had an armor-proof roof put on it, and was kept in service for years.
It was supposed to have a bubble on it that day, no?
It was, well, it could have. He was
the president didn't want it.
Person, he did not want it. I've ridden that motorcade route with protectees. We had the King of Spain come through once, and he specifically requested to do a motorcade through Dealey Plaza, and of course, we all, you know, double check our life insurance and say, sure, sir, let's do it.
Nuts. What, you know, when you travel to other countries with the president, that has to be hairier, right?
Especially depending on the countries you go to. I've traveled to well over 50 or 60 countries. I lost track with the president because you really are in the hands of the individual you're with. We can only bring so many assets. Now, we can bring more to bear, and we have more intelligence overseas by bringing in more three-letter agencies. And we're allowed more military support. While you'll see military in D.C. today, they don't have police powers. And because of Posse Comitatus, it's not the curse on your show, but they can't do any police activities on U.S. soil. And overseas, you don't have that issue. We can bring in the SEALs or Delta Force and so forth. But some countries are wonderful to go to because the police forces are very advanced and they have a better control of their citizens. And others are not so much. Probably the most difficult day of my career, maybe the name of my autobiography ever written, it will be called Breakfast in Kabul, Lunch in Islamabad, and Dinner in New Delhi.
Wow. That
one day where we spent 3 days in Afghanistan and then a day and a half in Islamabad, Pakistan.
Which president was that?
India. That was a national security advisor. Many people don't realize that the Secret Service right now has 40 different protectees, and they protect the president and his inner circle. But with the president alone, I've been in over 50 and it does get very difficult, especially if you're in a country like, say, Benin or a smaller country without much embedded security. You've got to bring it all with you. Even
who
a mobile
got President
hospital.
Carter when he was like laying in a wheelchair, pretty much passed out? Easiest gig.
Boy Scout.
Right? Don't get me started on former detail protection. There's a lot of competition in and among the Secret Service between, oh, I'm on the president's detail, I'm on the vice president's detail. There's no real tension, but it's a sort of a
That's what you want. That's the highest level.
you would think, and we do have some jokes. I was on the president's detail, a relatively unprecedented five times, because I'm a glutton for punishment. It's an extremely difficult assignment. Your family certainly pays the price, and you are almost never home. I had years I was home less than 100 days because you're traveling constantly, or you're at the White House constantly. Or in the last presidency, you spent it on the eastern shore of Delaware. But there's every presidency is different, and those challenges are extreme. Former presidents' details do tend to be smaller because they're based on the threat. President Carter did not have a robust security group towards the end, but he certainly had a very dedicated group of individuals that would not let anything happen to him that right. Nature wasn't already doing.
Man, this guy does his research.
Seriously.
He's out in the air telling us about us.
I forgot about us.
Like, oh, that's right. You're Secret Service.
I forgot about me.
You do research.
Damn.
I have a particular set of skills, yes.
99.1 PLR, Chaz and AJ in the morning. Paul Eckloff is on, retired Secret Service. Trump last night said he's going to release the JFK, the RFK, and MLK assassination files. What do you think is going to be in there?
That's an excellent question, and I can only speculate. What I've always found funny about the conspiratorial mindset of most Americans as they look at these things, and this is really true. We saw this play out this summer with the two assassination attempts. Because of a lack of knowledge, the brain fills in the gaps. You can stare at, you know, random colors and see faces and images, how the brain is wired. So as you don't get any information, we fill it in with conspiracy. As far as Kennedy, I've always told people, from knowing the ballistics, from being there, from having stood in that sixth floor window and been in Dealey Plaza when I started my career in Dallas, that it, to my knowledge and forensic shows, it was one gunman. It was Lee Harvey Oswald from that window with three shots from that, I believe, a Malik or Carcano. The question is why? I think there are legitimate questions as to potentially Jack Ruby killing him afterwards. There are questions as to his involvement with the Soviet Union and his motivation. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out. I will say that the files of the CIA and the FBI tend to be very, very elaborate, and they do tend to go down the rabbit hole on those investigations. So I'm afraid we'll end up with more questions than answers.
What about RFK?
RFK, that assassination falls in line with historical assassinations like the others, with Sirhan.
Just a nutbag?
What you tend to find is a gun and a grievance. You find an individual with a weapon and a grievance of some kind. And throughout history, if you look at all the assassination attempts, back to the very first where an individual went to shoot, I believe it was Andrew Jackson, and his gun misfired and ended up getting beaten by a very crotchety Andrew Jackson with his cane, you just had a single individual now with questionable motivations, some sort of mental illness or grievance. Some of them interesting and complex, and some less so. The assassination of President Garfield in 1881 in D.C. Is really kind of fascinating, because he bought the gun because when he picked it out, he picked out a fancy one so it would look better in a museum, because he knew and even told the president, "This would look great in a museum when I use it." Interestingly enough, it was my great-great-great-grandfather who arrested him after he killed President Garfield.
Wow. Really?
It absolutely. Horribly named Adolphus Eckloff was a lieutenant of the police force at the
How
time.
Cool is that?
Wow.
Well, it's strange, because that gun, after he testified at Charles Guiteau's trial, ended up in a family sock drawer until the 1970s. They donated it to a museum, and it was subsequently stolen. So nobody knows where that is. That's one presidential weapon that has been lost to history.
And Martin Luther King, that wasn't just a nutbag, right?
That's hard to say. There is a lot of speculation, because you have to look at the activity of the government monitoring and other things. Now, I tend to have a more benevolent view of the government, because when you say, well, the government did it, it was some guy like me who wanted nothing but security. I've even protected the president of Iran, not to compare the two. You know, MLK was such a beloved figure, but so disruptive to the status quo, which you really could say of Trump. I will certainly hope for the sake of America and the sake of what he means to so many people and the importance that he brought clearly to civil rights, that we see that it was just an assassination or somebody with racist motives. We use that assassination as in the training scenario because of the way that they used a diversionary fight to divert attention from the security personnel so they could be shot, with the Malcolm X and that shooting. It's fascinating. But, you know, I think one of his famous sayings was we didn't arrive on the same ship, but we're all in the same boat now. You know, we've got to work together. We've got to do something to bring down the temperature.
Let me ask you about Butler. I know that he didn't have a presidential Secret Service level protection, but there are a lot of mistakes made now.
There, you really wouldn't be able to count the number of mistakes that day, the lack of ownership. You really need agents and officers who go do a security plan and they assess everything. He had far from presidential level security, and a former president cannot and does not have the same threat level. He had, for the first time, a former president had counter sniper operatives there and counter assault operatives. And it's a good thing they were there, because it was that counter sniper who was able to take out the shooter before he could harm more people. But the exposure on that rooftop, the time of exposure, the number of people who saw it, and the fact that you had such a glaring, glaring collapse of a security plan, it's troubling. And not if it's troubling to the average person, it's just I've lost sleep. There were days that I didn't sleep, and many of my former agent friends as well. When we see, you always say that I could have been there and I could have stopped it. And that's a pathology that we all have. Whenever there's an attempt, we wish that we were there. We could have stood between the protectee and the bullet. We could have put it down. But that outer perimeter, inner perimeter sort of bleed over was horribly done. And it could have been solved with a banner, a bus, or the moving of even the bleachers about 20 feet.
The guy that was in charge of the counter sniper operation was never a real sniper. So isn't that weird to have someone who's never really done the job lead snipers?
I have no idea what that's referring to. The person, the counter sniper advancer is done by Secret Service snipers. If you mean he was never a military sniper,
right?
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you that the Secret Service counter sniper team are some of the most capable in the world. They have their own 1,000-yard shooting range on a military base, and they train out to choose which lung they will hit out to 1,000 yards. Now, their capability is much further, but that's what they discuss. They can hit a target, a headshot if need be, from 1,000 yards away. They're some of the most capable counter snipers in the world. People need to realize that there's a vast difference between a sniper and a counter sniper. A sniper's job is an offensive capability to take out a threat, generally is military with far different rules of engagement. A counter sniper, especially that of the police, has to operate in a law enforcement capacity under the same use of force continuum that the average officer does, you know, meeting force with force or slightly higher when you're using deadly force. And without a green light, the Secret Service counter sniper team does not need to get approval. If they see something that imposes a threat to life, they take it out. So I would say that criticism is entirely unfounded. The amount of snipers could have been increased, and certainly the use of a counter surveillance agent, even one, could have prevented it. But those are some of the most capable counter snipers in the world.
When someone like President Trump goes to McDonald's, how do you manage that kind of a situation? And do you guys test the food? How does that work?
I've had to test quite a bit of McDonald's, but starting with President Clinton all the way down. But when he generally when Trump goes to McDonald's, it's brought to him. But when the president goes to any restaurant or goes to get hamburgers, like in that case, we call it an OTR, an off-the-record movement. And the thinking behind it is if the assassin doesn't know he's going there, he can't set up and the plan cannot be elaborate. It would have to be a spur-of-the-moment plan. So if we know that the president is going to McDonald's, we will send undercover agents in first to sort of test the flavor of the room, and then perhaps an hour or so ahead of time, we'll send an advance agent in regular clothing to speak to the managers and only let the people who need to know. And then there are assets in place that start monitoring. As soon as the president arrives, everybody is magnetometered. Everything is monitored very heavily. And you'll see that the agents around him who sort of operate like an accordion, they'll move in and out as the situation or the threat spectrum changes. They operate in a lot closer proximity to the president.
So were you Secret Service during the Clinton administration?
I started in 1998, so I was very junior agent in counterfeit investigations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But you travel around the world as a post-ender, and you sort of, it's developmental throughout your career. So I did. I stood post and worked security for President Clinton as well. I just was not on his detail. The first president that I was assigned to his detail was George W. Bush.
When that Monica Lewinsky story came out, like a day later, he had a black eye. And there was rumors that, like, Hillary threw this candle holder right at him. Like, how would the Secret Service manage something like that if it's coming from inside the White House?
They're spread out.
It sounds like the movie. It's coming from inside the
right,
house.
Right, it's inside the house.
If it's in the residence area of the White House, there are areas that are so secure, and certainly the residence areas behind so many tiers and layers of security, that there aren't agents walking next to the president when he's moving from his bedroom to brush his teeth. So he's you can't protect him from a spouse that might be angry at him. I was a post-stander for the Clinton trip to Martha's Vineyard that summer, and it was known as the Doghouse Summer because a beautiful facility that we would walk around and protect. And it was a lot of time spent with the first dog, Buddy.
If he yells, take her out, take her out. You can't do it.
You know, even the Secret Service can't protect you from your wife. So right. It's, you know.
That's good to know.
Red dog, red
can't
dog.
Protect you from yourself. That's great. Absolutely correct. If you step in it, you got to own it.
Gotcha.
Listeners asked me to ask you about wedding rings. Are presidents not allowed to wear wedding bands?
There is no restriction that I'm aware of as far as wearing a wedding band. Most people in law enforcement will wear one made out of silicone because if it right. gets snagged during a fight, it doesn't deglove your finger or tear the skin off or break your finger.
Right.
I've never known there to be any. I'm pretty assumed. Pretty
yeah, I never heard that either.
Wear them. Yeah, that's a new one.
Who made that one up?
Yeah.
Somebody thinking of proposing to a president.
Clinton with that one.
Well, thank you for coming on, and thank you for your service. And we'll be watching today. Big day today.
Yeah, it's a big day. Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, man.
I hope you write that book, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have to sit down and get to writing.
Yeah, Paul Eckloff, retired Secret Service.